Hello, welcome to the Behind the Headlines podcast with me, John Crowley.
And me, Hannah Storm.
In our podcast, journalism colleagues tell us about the stories they've covered and we hear their own stories as well. They share with us why journalism matters to them and what motivates them to keep on bearing witness.
John and I are both directors of Headlines Network and have been involved in journalism for decades. We know that journalists aren't robots. They face pressures either because of the stories they cover or the situations they find themselves in wherever they work. Our industry is adapting to the realisation that it needs to take conversations around wellbeing more seriously, and it's our hope that these podcasts help with that.
For this episode, we are really pleased to welcome ABC correspondent James Longman. Throughout his career, James has covered conflict, political unrest, and disasters. He's also reported on stories deeply personal to him as well. James, thank you for joining us. Tell us, what was it that made you want to be a journalist?
A complete mistake, I think mostly. It just kind of happened. It was a love of the Middle East. That was what really started it. A love of spending time in the Middle East, a love of getting to know people there. I had was raised in kind of Middle Eastern background and family. My mother's Lebanese. And so I just always had Arabic in the house. And so I just was desperate when I was 18 to go off and live somewhere fun. And I kind of thought, well, where can I live? And I thought Syria looks great because I can go to Lebanon a lot. What can I do? I can do Arabic. And it was knowing how to speak Arabic that eventually got me a job at Sky. But it was all by mistake. I mean, it didn't happen on purpose at all.
So you mentioned that you began your career in Syria. Probably not the easiest of places to start out. I'm sure spending time in rebel-held areas before the war. How did that experience lay the foundations for the work you do today?
Well, it made me very concerned for the well-being of anybody that I speak to. I remember before I went, I must have been 22 when I went on my first trip, and I was going to go as a student and then ended up writing for some newspapers. And I remember a colleague at Sky News had told me, Dominic Waghorn, who still works at Sky, he said to me, just remember, James, anyone you speak to will be put into immediate danger. So you must remember that. Anybody in Syria who's seen speaking to a Westerner will be in the firing line. And so that, I think, has remained with me for the last, what are we now, like 15 years. A lot of places you go in the world, speaking to journalists is very dangerous. So trying to get in the headspace of the people that you're speaking with, I think that's the thing it really left me with.
You were hired by the BBC and spent several years working for them as a Middle East specialist. Looking back to that time, I think it's 2012, 2013 with the Arab Spring, so many things going on in that region. What stories would you say remain with you from that time?
Well, I think it was, I mean, some of the first work that I did when I was in Beirut was trying to speak to people who'd got out from some of the areas on the border with Lebanon. So if you cast your minds back, some of these towns on the border with Lebanon, places like Zabadani in Syria, I spoke to a young boy who was 12 years old. And he spoke to me about trying to take his life because where he was living had become so unlivable. Hezbollah had surrounded the town. There was no way in or out. They're running out of food. And he tried to end his life by throwing himself off a building. And that was one of the first stories I think I ever did. And I've always remembered that, chiefly because the whole time I spoke to him, I just felt very guilty because I felt that I was benefiting from his heartache. That was my main concern. And much the same way as Dominic had said to me, remember, anybody you talk to will suffer if they speak to you. I was racked with guilt, this idea, and I think it just continues to this day, this transactional nature of our job, where we've got to speak to people who are going through possibly the worst day of their lives, and you're asking them to relive it for you, for your job, and what do they get out of it? I always have struggled with that, and I think speaking to him really made me think about that. And that's why I try my hardest when I speak to people to be as compassionate as I humanly can be, because they're giving you something of themselves. And you have nothing to return. You can sell them the idea as much as you like that their story will serve a greater purpose. And of course it will. That is the reason why we do this job, right? To tell people the truth of what's going on in places where they can't get to. But for him individually, why would he benefit? And that's the guilt that I carry, I think, all the time when we do this job.
How do you manage that? How do you carry that guilt and manage it and kind of, I guess, use it to motivate yourself, but also manage your own mental health?
I talk to Alex a lot, my new husband, actually. I was married earlier this year. And I find it really helps to talk in the moment. I have to talk very soon after I see something I didn't really want to see, or I spoke to someone and it was sad. I find leaving it until I get home too difficult. So often I need to talk to Alex right away. And it does help to reflect on why you're there. You know, when I was in, just I've spent a lot of time this year in Ukraine. And again, you know, you're asking people to give of themselves. And I think you've got to remind yourself with your team, spending time with your team who are all going through it together, sharing these stories with people that you're working with and reminding each other why you're there. Because in Ukraine, you know, for example, Russia is trying to tell a very different story. So it actually serves an incredibly useful purpose to be in Ukraine at the moment. So, of course, like everything, it's talking as much as possible with people who are witnessing it with you, but people who have no idea, who are back home and who also need to hear from you.
Congratulations on your nuptials to Alex. If we can speak a little bit more about James the person rather than James the journalist, although it does overlap a little. You've been very open about your sexual identity. How did you find working in the Middle East and other parts of the world where being gay isn't welcome? There's one particular instance that I'm thinking of. There's a story around how you came out to a Chechen police chief. Can you explain that story? How did that go down?
So we told the Chechens that we wanted very much to come to see what it was like in Grozny. And we weren't hiding anything. It wasn't going to be a gotcha moment. But the reason we were going was to document the alleged crimes being perpetrated against gay people specifically, because it still continues. Gay people are taken off the streets and they're murdered. They're often shot by their own families and then the security services disappear them. And so we wanted to go and see what was actually happening, but we needed to find a way to go and do that. They allowed us to go to Grozny. But everything in a place like that seems to happen by chance or by accident or by luck. And we went to see this woman who we were told can do anything. She was this kind of magic fixer lady who had sort of various different links with the government that we weren't quite clear on. She had this office in this strip mall of beauty parlours, and it was like sort of 10 beauty parlours. In the middle of it, there was this kind of random tiny office where apparently one of the most powerful women in Chechnya worked. And so we went to talk to her and we said, well, listen, we know we've heard about this stuff with gay men being taken off the streets. We'd love to be able to speak to someone about it. She goes, oh, let me make a call. So she makes this call. She puts the phone down. She goes, the head of our police service will be here in 10 minutes. And we thought, oh God, is he going to be here in 10 minutes to take us away? Or is he going to be here in 10 minutes to talk to us? This man is actually sanctioned by the United States, is on the sanctions list. And he turned up, and this is exactly how you would imagine. It's like a sort of dictator taken from central casting. He had a very deep laugh. He found himself very funny. And he said, yes, of course, I'll take you on a tour of Grozny. So we ended up wandering around Grozny at 11 o'clock at night with this guy. And he was very open about it. And then he took us to dinner. And then we said, well, casually over dinner, we said, would you mind terribly? We've heard about these gays being rounded up. You're in charge of the police service. It's kind of your jurisdiction. He's like, let me take you to a police cell. Let me take you to a jail. And we said, okay, it's 1 o'clock in the morning at this point. We're like, oh God, we're going to go to a jail with this man. We go pile into this car. We're driving. And there's a moment actually in the edit where we've taken it out, but the cameraman, you can hear him, asked me, James, we've been driving for 30 minutes. Where are we going? Because we thought it was in Grozny, but it was actually quite far away. Anyway, we arrive at this place. He's got his men out on the kind of forecourt and they're all heavily armed. They don't look like normal policemen. They certainly look like sort of SWAT police. And then we end up in this prison cell. And the whole time I had absolutely no intention of saying to him that I was gay. None at all. That wasn't the point. I mean, Lise Doucette says this. She says, the audience doesn't care what you're feeling. They just want to know the fact. And to put yourself in a story is not necessary. And she's absolutely right. And that's what I have felt very strongly. It would be powerful to the audience to know if they knew they happened to know I was gay, that I was there, but I'm not necessarily going to bring it up. Anyway, we're in this cell and I say in English to our producer and the cameraman, guys, I think he's in a good mood. I might tell him. And they knew what I meant because he doesn't understand any English. And you just hear this kind of murmuring agreement from everyone. They say, yeah, go on. And I tell him I'm gay. And he needs a couple of times to go through the translation. Poor guy, the producer had to translate it into Russian. He was the one to actually say that I was gay. And then he does his big ho, 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 cackle, his big laugh. It reverberates around. But behind the camera, and I can see them, but camera and producer can't, are like 15 huge Chechen guys with these massive muscles. I mean, everyone there, all the security forces are absolutely huge. And you can just hear them going, gay, 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 gay. It sort of reverberates all the way down this. And I was so nervous about it. I took his hand and I put it on my chest because my heart was beating really fast. And I wanted to prove to him, and I don't speak Russian. So I had to say, I said, feel that. And then it made him just laugh even more. And then it kind of got a bit awkward, but then we left the prison as soon as we could. And then I went back to the hotel. And when we were in the hotel, I put the chair up against the door because I just thought, if they're going to burst in here, at least give me sort of 10 extra seconds to press our alarm on our phones. Yeah, so I don't sure what I was thinking really, but it felt natural in that moment. And I get a lot of messages about it, a lot from gay men and from a lot of Chechens who on both sides, you know, a lot of gay Chechens who are living in fear around the world, who are chased down, by the way. You know, they don't let them go. Once they've left Chechnya, they hunt them down. And a lot of Chechens who say if they had ever seen me, they would chop my head off. But I felt there was a power in that moment because I was literally in the prison cell where they are supposed to have been holding gay men for being gay. So it wasn't a plan. It may have been reckless, but I survived.
As you say, you've recently married Alex. Congratulations. That was after coming back from Ukraine. And just while we were preparing to have this chat, you said something like you'd been overseas for 18 weeks, did you say, so far this year? We're recording this at the start of August. 18 weeks is a lot of time to be away. Was that the kind of reason why you decided to get married? I mean, you said you did the legal stuff, you're going to do the party next year. What was it about that Ukraine experience that cemented that idea to, I've got to get married now?
Yeah, it's funny you put it that way. And actually, I'm now realizing it might have been like the Ukraine experience that made me feel like I wanted to solidify my connection to Alex. He said something very sweet. He said, it's like we've always lived in a house, but now we've poured the foundations. And I thought that was a really nice way to see it. And yes, I actually had wanted to come back from Ukraine and immediately go to City Hall and just do a quick legal thing. And I thought it'd be romantic to fly back from Ukraine. He'd pick me up from the airport and we'd go straight to city. But unfortunately, the level of bureaucracy in this country means you've got to give them so much notice. There was all of that romance was immediately torpedoed. But I gave them notice and then I went away to Ukraine again. So by the time I came back from my second 6 week stint, I was back a week before and then we were married. Yeah, we were going to wait to do the legal bit next year just before we do a fun party abroad. But I wanted to do it this year. And yes, I think because, well, our relationship probably survives because I'm away so much, if I'm brutally honest. It's actually really healthy for us that I'm away. I think 18 weeks is probably a bit much. And it was, I think he wouldn't mind me saying that he found that distance, I think, very difficult. But I think I did need to come back and feel that I was coming back to like a very stable unit because my life is not very stable. And Alex has provided that stability and I wanted to, as he says, put those foundations in. I actually found a big difference between the first return and the second return from Ukraine. The first time I came back, it was still very much in the headlines in the UK at least. And I felt that that was easier for me to deal with the kind of shock of return. You know, you're in a place like Kharkiv, which is empty and you're hearing bombardments. And then you come back to London and people are in the park and you overhear conversations on the tube about Love Island and it can be a shock, but at least in the news, I felt on the platforms I was plugged into, people were still talking about Ukraine. So it was almost like I was being let down easy. Whereas the second time I came back and it was just full-fledged Boris Johnson, Tory party meltdown, there was very little Ukraine in the UK news, at least that I could see, or at least it wasn't as prominent as it has been in the United States. And so I actually found that really hard. I felt very lonely when I came back from Ukraine on the second trip because I felt like I'd just gone completely cold turkey. It was gone. Everything that I had been doing no one seemed to care when I came back. Not about me particularly, but about the story that I'd been covering. And it just felt the world had moved on. The team I had been spending day in, day out with, we'd been sleeping in cars in one instance, a brothel, don't mind telling you, unused now. it was really hard to get my frame of mind back in. And then a week after that, I got married. So full 180.
I was going to ask you about how do you decompress? Do you have a way of doing it? I guess marrying is a way of decompressing 1 week after you come back. But apart from this time, you know, as you said, everything kind of feels banal. But we've spoken to other people when they come back from conflict zones, and that banality is something that you can reach out to as well. But again, particularly when you felt that the world has moved on from Ukraine, did you find this time particularly difficult?
Yeah, the second trip back, I found very, very hard. I found it hard because I had no routine to come back to. You have to know yourself, or you have to be surrounded by people who know you better than you know yourself. And in my case, that's Alex. And Alex said, you need more of a routine than this. You can't just come back and spend the day at the pool and see if your friends are about. I have a very solid, and I'm very lucky to have a large group of friends who I love. They're my family, because, you know, we'll discuss it, but I don't have huge numbers of people in my family. So my relationship with my friends is really important to me, but they also have normal jobs. So you can't message someone at sort of 3 o'clock on a Tuesday and expect them to be there for you. So what I try and do is make as many plans as possible. I flood my diary with stuff, because otherwise if I feel like a loose end, it really does start to grate, because when you're in a place like Ukraine and you're on email and you're on WhatsApp and you're on Signal and you're talking to your colleagues all the time about what your story is that night, that morning, that afternoon, you're trying to check in with Alex as much as possible. And all your friends message you a lot when you're in a place like Ukraine. You get messages all the time, and then you come back, they know you're safe, and then the messages stop. And that's actually that I need the messages when I get back. I don't really need them when I'm in there. And so, yeah, that's what I find to be a bit hard.
When we first met, it was in circumstances that had a really profound effect on me. And I don't think I've shared this with you, but I remember seeing you on stage at News Exchange, a journalism industry conference, and hearing you speaking openly about your own mental health. And it was a real light bulb moment for me. It was one of those kind of moments where I started to feel like I might be able to share my own experience of post-traumatic stress. Tell us a little bit more about what motivates you to speak about your experiences of depression and mental ill health.
Not to be judgmental of myself, but I mean, they're purely selfish in one sense, because I just want to find out. I want to find out what it was that made my father ill. He had schizophrenia, and what it was that made his father ill. And my uncle also spent a lot of time in and out of mental health institutions. And why I got sad in my 20s. So it was, I just wanted to know. I was trying to put together the dots. And I was like, well, I'm at the BBC. Maybe I can make a program and they can help me find out, because it's always been this kind of looming question. And I think a lot of people who have mental health issues in families, because there's stigma, and there has been, even inside the family, there are truths and half-truths and outright lies. And I just was never told the truth about what happened to my father. So I just wanted to find out. And I hoped that I could make sense of my own sadness by looking at what made my father and his father ill. You know, I'm very proud to be like my dad in many ways. I'm always told I look like him, that I have his same mannerisms. And that has always made me very happy. When you lose a parent at a young age, you can romanticize them a bit. And I've always looked at my dad like that. They're kind of frozen in time, if you like. But then whilst being proud of what I have from him, I've always worried about sort of lurking illness that he might have passed on to me. So, you know, I was quite keen to work that out. And knowing as well that it affects so many people. I mean, it's literally everybody. So, I mean, everyone, in fact, it doesn't just affect everybody, doesn't it? I mean, there's no point saying so many people. It literally affects everybody.
And you're using those journalism skills to research into something that your dad and your granddad didn't have the capacity to do. And so you lost your dad and your grandfather to suicide, something that is still, unfortunately, in 2022, shrouded in shame and stigma and secrecy. And you've spoken openly about the kind of secrecy that I guess that they had to encounter. And then you made this really extraordinary program about this idea that whether you had inherited mental illness. How important is it to you that we are able to have more open conversations about suicide and about how we can kind of try to tackle some of the taboos around it?
Well, it's interesting, because I think my answer to that a few years ago would have been different to now. Then, when we met and when we were doing that talk, it's funny, any conversation about mental health, I thought, absolutely, we should be having it. You know, however people understand mental health, we need to be having some kind of conversation. In the intervening years, I feel like it's become so much more of a conversation. There's been so much more dialogue about it. You just see it everywhere now. Everybody wants to talk about their mental health, to a point where I think it's kind of mental health light. people have confused mental health with stress. And actually, what I'm talking about when I talk about my father, he had a medical condition, and so did his grandfather and my uncle, and I did in my 20s. And I think that it's really important that we don't allow the conversation to move to a place where we're comfortable. You know, in the US, they talk about having, you need a mental health day. Now, I get the sentiment, and it might be the right terminology, but I'm not sure it is. If you're having a hard day at work, that's different to dealing with sort of really, really profound and really rather complex issues that many, many people experience. So I think it's desperately important now more than ever to talk about these things, to make the conversation more difficult rather than allow it to move into this space where everyone can share their feelings, which is really important. But if you like, kind of try to avoid some of the darker elements of mental health, which exist and which are really, really common.
Talking about difficulty, you've been very courageous talking about your own story. I know this might be difficult to share, but you've spoken before about how you found yourself on a London curb contemplating suicide by walking out into traffic. If you feel comfortable to talk about it, how did you come to that point? And more importantly, how are you doing now?
I think it was an overwhelming sense of just being pure and simple alone. I felt that I was operating in a kind of alternate universe. I don't know if you've seen, if you've ever watched The Northern Lights or read the book, but there are these two worlds that exist. They are the same world, but people in one world can't see people in the other, even though they exist in the same physical location. And that's how I felt. I felt like I was in this kind of dream world where I was there, but no one could really see me. And then for that reason, it wouldn't matter if I wasn't there anymore because they couldn't see me anyway. And I don't really know how I got there because it kind of crept up on me. And then suddenly at work, I had a panic attack, and what I know to be now a panic attack. And I just felt just completely, I didn't feel anything. It's not that I felt sad. I honestly just didn't feel anything. And what helped, the one person that helped was one of my closest friends who came to physically pick me up and take me home. And it's, I think the experience, having been that low, knowing that you can be that low, I think if you're conscious of it, then you can be conscious of remaining as high as you possibly can and knowing what keeps you high. And that's my friends, and that's Alex. And that's telling these people when I'm going towards that space again. But thankfully, I haven't been close to that again. But it was terrifying. I was terrified by my own feelings. It was kind of a weird, it's weird to be terrified by yourself, but I was.
It really resonates what you say there about that kind of fear of yourself. We're talking about quite a long time ago now, this experience that you had, right?
Yeah, this is 2016.
So in the grand scheme of things, not that long ago, but some time ago. I wanted to just pick up on this point that you made about having the difficult conversations, because I think this is, it's so important. What are the responsibilities do you feel as for us as journalists to try to have these difficult conversations and try to shape the way that we as a wider community and our audiences perhaps see mental health?
Oh, goodness. I suppose I felt that sharing my own story was one of those ways. It's hard when you're supposed to have a degree of separation from the work that you're doing. It's funny because now I work for an American network. Americans are better at this. They're better at talking about their feelings, more generally, I think, my experience anyway. And they're not afraid to allow their journalists to not tell you what they think necessarily, although obviously there are networks that do that in the US, but ours isn't one of them, but to show you how they feel about something. I think that's okay. And that's what I try and do. But on the specific issue of suicide prevention, and you've just got to ring the bell as hard as you can, haven't you? You've got to cover these stories. You've got to be highlighting when things aren't going well. You know, for me, and when I covered my father, it was an opportunity to talk about mental health care provision in this country when he was going through his difficulties, and when finally he ended his life in 1996. He had gone to hospital a number of times. My mother had taken him, friends had taken him to A&E after he'd had an episode, and he had 3 or 4 suicide attempts. And the people at hospital, who was in central London, had said that we literally don't have anywhere to put him. There isn't a place for him. We cannot have him here. There's nothing we can do. Even sectioning him had a time limit, and he was left back out onto the street and was seen by one neighbour. I remember when I went to speak to people, it was just kind of in a dressing gown, bathrobe, lying in a bush by the side of the road. I mean, that really makes me sad to think that he had to go through that. And if we're not careful in this country, if mental health care provision isn't provided for, then we're going to end up in the same place. And that is horrible to think about.
It really concerns me when I hear from people that speaking about suicide is going to lead to people taking their lives. That really concerns me, and it angers me quite a lot as well. And I've spoken with journalists who are like, oh, we can't possibly talk about it. But there are ways and means of speaking about it in a sensitive way, as you've mentioned, and also in a way that ring that bell. We've got such a kind of issue in the moment in the UK around mental health provision. Surely it must be incumbent on us as journalists to ethically and sensitively report on suicide in a way that is going to show that this is preventable.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a health issue. There's no judgment involved. You would talk about cancer. You would talk about any of these things, smoking. I mean, these are all just as serious, or actually, in many cases, many of these health issues are less serious in terms of an epidemic. So why can't you talk about suicide? I mean, I care quite a lot about language. So I hear quite a lot of people talking about committing suicide, which makes me quite angry. It sounds very simple, but actually it's really, really good to try to change the way people just use certain words, because they don't realise that they're making a judgment and using the word committed.
We've spoken about the language around suicide there. To what extent do you feel conversations around mental health more broadly are improving in our industry, in journalism, certainly after the COVID pandemic?
Well, they do seem that they are improving. I mean, I know my workplace, we get a lot of people reaching out a lot of the time about how we are coping with our work. Again, I think Americans have a better kind of, I don't know, culture of it, checking in with people a little more often. We had a call just the other day about all the counselors that are available to us, anyone who was in Ukraine. So, yeah, I think it feels like it's got a lot better. I think journalism in general has changed from being this very kind of masculine, hard drinking, you know, work all hours at God sends and don't think about your mental or physical health in any way whatsoever. And it's changed a lot because the kinds of people who are coming into journalism, and that's really good. So I think diversity in journalism actually helps us in our mental health, because you get people from different walks of life. And I think that changes the culture and the ethos of the place as well.
What more do you feel might be done in terms of conversations to support people from a mental health perspective in journalism? You talked there about there was quite a kind of toxic culture. I'm in my mid-40s now, and when I started journalism in the 90s, there was a very heavy drinking culture. There was a lot of risky sexual behaviour. There was a lot of leadership that was not healthy. Coping ugly, Sian Williams calls it, I think. And I think she took that phrase from elsewhere. And there still is elements of that, right? I mean, let's not be kind of completely naive to it. There's elements of that. But what more do you think our industry could be doing to promote better mental health and therefore that issue around diversity and retention and inclusivity as well?
More podcasts like these.
Excellent. Thank you.
There you go.
We're not paying you for this, yeah. Are we? No.
I mean, honestly, I think just it's the same. People ask you, well, how you deal with your own mental health, and it's talking, isn't it? So then by extension, it's more talking, isn't it? I if I knew what I could actually do to actually really change the thing, I'd become like kind of some kind of manager, I guess. I'm just kind of bouncing around as a reporter.
We're not bouncing. I mean, we hear from managers, many of our colleagues, managers, they're struggling themselves. So they kind of don't know even where to start the conversation. A lot of the kind of the tools that we employ in journalism that make us good journalists, the empathy, the sense of kind of like listening and listening non-judgmentally, are tools I think that we could bring into our conversations around mental health too, surely.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Also, it's about, I think, maybe getting people who everyone respects to be able to speak out, I think. And that really does make a big, big difference. Because for me, I'll give you one example. You know, Fergal Keane has always been a great, great example to me of someone who is not only a good journalist, but a great human being. And he's spoken very openly about his struggles. He helped me out a lot when I was a young journalist at the BBC. He was kind of a mentor to me. So journalism actually lends itself very well to mentor schemes. And if mentoring can take that kind of mental health theme on board, then on an individual basis, that would be a lovely way of fixing an issue in the workplace. Looking around for those people who are just kind of sages, like Fergal, I've always remembered his kindness.
we're hoping to have Fergal on the podcast at some stage because he really is a real role model for a lot of people. And I think it's that point about, back to what I said earlier, hearing you speak about your experiences, it gives people a degree of permission and it gives people a degree of ownership and feeling like they're less alone.
Yes, talking about journalism changing, James, we've also got social media. You seem very relaxed about showing yourself away from work. I've seen shots of you on Instagram post-workout. Are you relaxed about kind of showing that multiple side to your character and just showing that brains and brawn aren't mutually exclusive?
I am not relaxed about it at all. I find social media terrifying. It's a necessary evil. There's a word I'm going to use now, which if you completely unplug and throw away both your computers, I won't be offended. But it's all part of this brand that you're supposed to have. I've said the word brand. I'm very sorry. So there's this kind of pressure, journalism specifically. You know, you're walking this line between what you're telling the audience is happening, but their interest in you as a person as well. And again, I keep talking about America, but I apologize, but I do work for the American network. It is something which is stronger in the United States. And I think it's great for many reasons. And I think it also is not as good. My experience at the BBC was that you could be a little bit more separated from what you're covering. And I think that was also the time at which I was working at the BBC. I think maybe things have changed now. The pressure is enormous. It is terrifying. I have meetings with a department at my agency where there's a person who runs all the analytics on all my social media, who tells me what time of day I should be sharing things and how well they do and the kinds of videos I should be posting. And it's always the same sort of stuff. You know, you've got to make sure it's behind the scenes and anything you can share about your life. And some of the suggestions, not from them, but some of the suggestions I get from other people are completely absurd. I'm not a contestant on Love Island. But it's just this idea that you want to live in this world where you're constantly being engaging and you're engaged. So the answer to that question is I find it awful. And if I wasn't working in journalism, I probably wouldn't have social media. But you've got to have it. So how do you manage it? Make sure you realize it's not real. It's not real. Even if I'm giving you the behind the scenes real look, that isn't real because it's a moment in time in my life that you couldn't possibly know anything about. I could be having the worst day ever. I could have had a massive fight with Alex. Everyone around me that you see in this photograph might hate me. You don't know that. Everything you see on my social media is a dream. And that is what I always try and keep in mind when I'm looking at everybody else's social media and feeling the need to throw my phone out the window. This is what social media does. You think that I'm some kind of master of social media who's able to balance these two things. And I don't feel I am at all. I think I'm completely useless at it and I find it very stressful to manage. So all I can try and do is do on social media what I try and do on TV, which is just talk to people like they're my friend, like I'm talking to you now. But it is a necessary evil. It's like, you know, a mortgage. You just have to have it.
And tax, you just got to pay it, right?
Yeah, of course, I absolutely love it that people are able to get in touch. I mean, social media is brilliant for that. You know, I really do value all the messages I get and being able to speak to complete strangers who are watching our work at ABC. I really do value that. What I'm talking about is the kind of wider reality of what it means for your professional life and the impact it has on your private life and having to walk the line between the two. That's what I find very difficult.
But I've just been checking your Instagram while we've been speaking and you have got 124,000 followers on Instagram, which is better than my 226. So clearly brand James Longman is doing okay.
Well, the thing is that's the thing. And we all live in this world where it matters and you've got to have one.
It shouldn't.
And yeah, and the next person's got 200 and therefore they're more valuable. They can ask for more money at their next contract negotiation. These are real things. These are real conversations that people have. And so it's terribly, terribly pressure inducing and terrifying. Today, for instance, I got a letter from someone who was in jail in Wisconsin. And I'd never received a letter from someone in jail before, so I thought I would share what he had written to me from jail, which I thought was quite fun. But guaranteed, I'll have a lot of people writing to me saying, how dare you share the letter? I mean, I didn't share his name, obviously, but, you know, you can't do anything right. So it's like Jeremy Bowen says, when he covers the Middle East, it's like, as long as you're getting enough complaints from both sides, then you're fine.
It's really refreshing hearing you talk about that distinction between the social media reality, filtered reality, and the reality. There is a flip side, though, isn't there? And I don't know whether you've been exposed to some of this flip side, the kind of dark, seedy side. You know, a lot of the journalists we've spoken with have experienced online harassment, and that weighs heavy on people emotionally. I know that gay men are often more exposed to online harassment than straight men, for instance. Is that something that you've had to deal with?
Yeah, we shared some photographs of our wedding. And got a few comments about, you know, why we will burn in hell and all the rest of it. It's
You'd be happy though, right? You'd be happy together, burning in hell, I suppose.
Exactly, maybe, yeah, but... exactly. You've just got to make light of it. I mean, you're not supposed to really engage. You know, don't engage with the trolls. That's what they say. Sometimes I just can't help it. And I do reply. I try and be funny about it and I often fail. But you do get it. But actually, I'm actually pretty good with the online abuse because I do imagine that their lives are pretty thin and I can't allow something like that to upset me. I've got other things going on in my life that are more upsetting. So it doesn't upset me too much. But yeah, it does happen. And if you get actual threats and sort of strangers on the internet, that can worry me. And that's happened a couple of times. But most of the time, it's water off a duck's back.
You've spoken about stories that have affected you in the past. Is there one story that you think about years and years on that you still carry with you?
I mean, there are quite a lot, but it's not years and years. It was just this year. I met a man called Mikola who lived in Bucha, and you will have seen what happened in Bucha. And I have never met anyone who physically shook from trauma. I've met people who had family members executed by ISIS in front of them. I've had people who've lost their children to terror attacks. I've seen some pretty nasty things, but there was something about Mikola which was just completely soul crushing. We met him in Bucha. He was lining up to get food, kind of quietly shuffling along. He's a tall man, he's a large man, crystal blue eyes. And a local producer started talking to him a little bit, and he said, "Oh, I live around here and there was something horrible that happened in my garden." And we said, "Well, okay, would you like to show us?" And we walked around, and then he showed us where he had had to bury his three friends, his neighbours. When the Russians came, he said, they asked all the men to come downstairs, and then they asked anyone under the age of 50 to put their hands up. Two of the friends were among those men. They were immediately shot. He was stood next to his best friend, who was shot next to him. And then he was asked to bury them, so they were buried in shallow graves. So he went to live in the basement while these Russian soldiers had taken his apartment from him. And then a few days later, he was in the basement, another neighbour was next to him, and they just lobbed a grenade down there, and he exploded. And he was then made to pick up the pieces of his friend, including his head, put it in a plastic bag, and again bury it next to the other two individuals that had already been killed. I mean, I've heard a lot of horrible things, and that, for me, there was something which was just crushing because he had lived this kind of completely idyllic life until then. It's kind of bucolic. Bucha is actually really quite pretty. And I went back a couple of weeks ago, and when I was there before, it was obviously kind of winter, but when you go back, it's beautiful, it's green, it's got so many flowers everywhere, it's a lovely place to live. And he had a great life, and they torpedoed his life and his mind. And I was stood there asking him questions about these three men who were buried just next to us. And he'd actually developed a stutter. I think about him a lot. And we went back to see him when we got back the second time. And I said, "I have to go and see how Mikola is." And then we knocked on his door and he opened it, and it took him a split second of recognition. And then he gave me a big hug and kissed me repeatedly on the cheek. And that just felt so good, because I don't want to go around the world destroying people's lives, right? I don't want to go around the world making people relive the most awful thing that they or anyone else could ever experience and then just kind of leave and say, "Thanks for that. We got a great piece. You know, my bosses are really happy. It's going to go in for an Emmy. We're going to be awarded. And you, meanwhile, are going to live in this horrible flat, which you now have to live in because you can't go anywhere else. And you have to remember your neighbors that died." I told you, we started this conversation feeling this guilt, and that's what I feel all the time. And I wish I could go back to every single person I've ever met who's told me a horrible story, but it's never possible. And I was able to go back and talk to him. And because of the piece that we did, because a lot of Ukrainians saw it, he got some help, he got some counselling. But I mean, that, I just can't. I remember there was a US colleague of mine who made a very unwise and very, I think, oversimplified effort at talking about what happens in the Middle East versus what happens in Europe. And there was a great discussion about how, you know, it's more shocking to us because these people are white, and whereas people in the Middle East are used to this, quote unquote, used to this. What I would say is that death for Mikola was hundreds of thousands of miles away from him. He'd never seen it. He didn't watch it. It wasn't on his news. It's not part of his existence. death was not close to him like it has been, sadly, for many people, for example, in Syria, which is a country I love. So the wave of this nightmarish wave that flooded over him when this happened to him was palpable when you see him, and he still shakes when you talk to him. So yeah, I don't think I'll forget Mukola.
Wow. Just listening to you to share that experience, so many thoughts going around my head, and just such a horrific experience for him to have to deal with. It takes us back to what you were saying at the start of this conversation around Dominic Waghorn telling you about the kind of impact on people, the contributors. How do you deal with having to report on the pure and utter evil that some people perpetrate against others? How do you manage that?
A lot of the time you're prepared for it, so you can get in a space where you need to see it. We went to a basement in Bucha as well, where they had discovered four bodies, and we knew what we were going to go and see. I mean, what we saw was horrible, but we kind of were prepared. I remember in Syria, we were outside Baghouz, remember that was the last ISIS town, and these people were leaving, and we were told that they'd be in pretty bad state, and they were. I mean, there were children who were literally just covered in what can only describe as probably sewage. I mean, it was just, and they were bloodied, and they had lost limbs, and there was a girl who'd lost an eye that day. Also, I mean, it was just, we didn't know what we'd see, but we knew there was something horrific. So to get yourself in that place for me is quite important. And I found coming back this time from Ukraine a little hard because I had seen something I wasn't expecting to see. And when it sneaks up on you, we were at Kremenchuk at the mall that should sadly been hit by a missile from Russia. And we had thought it was just the cleanup of the building. And I was just next to the building and I just turned. I happened to look down and there were these two men with a canvas sheet with a torso on it, which had been sort of charred with one arm, nothing else. And I hadn't expected to see it. And I still think about it now. If I close my eyes, sometimes I can still see it because I hadn't prepared myself. So the first thing is, before you do it, even if you've got 5 seconds, you just have to turn your mind on like that. And then you just have to remember that you're there for a reason. And, you know, in a place like Ukraine, it's actually really, really important that people are in Ukraine at the moment because Russia is telling everybody else the opposite is happening. So that is also, not to sound too worthy about it, but it is kind of the reason you become a journalist, so you can tell people the truth. And so try to keep that in mind. And we felt actually weirdly justified or vindicated in a way, because I appeared on Russian television 3 times in mock-up versions of our reports, which were telling the opposite story. So they had employed an actor to use my voice to then say things like, oh, we haven't found enough actors. In Bucha, for instance, they'd said the whole thing was staged. So when you know you're making an impact or you're hitting a nerve, then that, I think, makes you feel a bit better about it.
What you said there about preparing, we hear a lot this term, emotional flak jacket. So we're sent into the war zones with the ballistics vests and the helmet, but less so, I think, with the emotional flak jacket. So preparing ourselves for what we might see. I think it's so important that you've mentioned that. I also just want to pick up on the sense of aftercare. You know, we talked before about decompressing and speaking with Alex, but what can the industry be doing in terms of aftercare for people if they've been through difficult situations?
Well, organisations need to have counsellors on hand immediately. What's not helpful is sometimes you can ask for help and they say, well, you go and find the help and we'll pay for it. And that's not really the same. It's a bit like when you have a problem with your broadband and rather than fix it, your provider asks you to go and fiddle with a router for 3 hours. And that's not what you want. You want someone to come and actually just do it. And I think that's the same when you come back from a place like this. You don't want to be given instructions on what to do. You want someone literally to call you and then just talk to you. And that's luckily what ABC has set up. And I don't know if that's the same for other organizations, but you just can't make it hard, because when I get sad or when sadness is creeping in, you just lose energy. And then it's the energy that you need to actually help yourself. You don't have energy, you can't help yourself. So someone else needs to be more proactive.
Just on that note, we ask all of our participants, contributors, colleagues for a piece of advice that they'd like to share with our listeners around mental health. So what can you do to help support your own mental health?
Just be honest with how you feel. Be honest with yourself about how you're feeling about something. You can talk to other people, you can do all those things that people tell you, but if you're not really honest with yourself about how you feel about something, then the talking won't make a difference. I think it's recognizing in yourself that things aren't good. That's the hardest thing. And it's just about being honest, because you have to get over that shame, I think.
We've sort of touched on it already. We also asked this question as well, why journalism matters, why it is important. What would you say to that, James?
I think it matters now, weirdly, in a very different way to why it perhaps used to matter. It now matters in the modern age because there's so much information out there. In a way, there's too much information. We desperately need people who've dedicated their lives to distilling all that information and telling you what's useful, but most importantly, what's true. I work in an organization which is kind of surrounded by other media organizations in the United States who are dedicated to opinion news. And so we live in this kind of bifurcated society where all opinions are polarized and you're being shouted at from every direction. I think journalism matters because you need people you can trust to tell you what's actually happening in the world, because there's so much information out there.
James, thank you very much for speaking to us today. It's been a pleasure and a privilege.
Thank you. I'm very grateful for your time.
Wow, that was a searingly honest conversation. And my big takeaway was what he just said just at the end there, around being true to yourself, being honest with yourself as much as you can.
I agree, John. But I think also just the power of conversation and the power of speaking your story. This is the mission of Headlines Network, isn't it? Promoting more open conversations about mental health. And what James said there about hearing other stories is so important.
Please remember to share this podcast with friends, families, and colleagues, and you'll find us on all the usual channels. Tune in again next time.